Of course, outfits are a huge part of the fun at the big awards shows, and tis the season. The Golden Globes just passed, the Grammys 2 days off, the Oscars not long after. So it's a good time to catch up on last year's movies and check up on the red carpet. It's also a good time to read about the glamorous life. Here's writer Kevin Roos with a book recommendation for the run-up to Oscar mania.
I'm not really into the Oscars. I don't care that much about the stars, and I haven't seen most of the movies. But there is one book that made me want to quit my job, move to L.A., and see Hollywood up close. It's Jess Walter's novel, Beautiful Ruins. The book is about a young woman named Claire. She's an assistant to a movie producer who's a bit past his prime. He once worked on Cleopatra with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, but now he's in a slump. He's had so much plastic surgery that he looks like a lacquered elf. And Claire spends all day hearing pitches for reality shows like Drunk Midget House. The book begins as a send-up. We see Hollywood in all of its crass commercial glory, washed-up stars who refuse to get out of their silk pajamas, and greedy studio executives. But by the end, we realize the joke's on us. We're the audience clamoring for lowbrow reality shows, and Hollywood's just giving us what we want. The book is sharpest when it's exploring that space, the one that TV and film occupy in our lives. It turns out that even the most low-budget productions can be genuinely meaningful when they become part of our common cultural experience. One aspiring screenwriter in the book makes the connection between film and religion. Wasn't the theater our temple, he asks, the one place we enter separately but emerge from 2 hours later together with the same experience, same guided emotions, same moral? It's a convincing epiphany, and it makes me want to pay attention to what happens this awards season. If Jess Walter's right, there's something much more important going on at the Oscars than stars, red carpets, and the glittering mess of Hollywood.
The book is Beautiful Ruins by Jess Walter. It was recommended by New York Magazine writer Kevin Roos. His new book, Young Money, comes out next month. There are tons of books about how parents affect their children's lives. Not so many about how kids change their parents' lives. Well, writer and mother Jennifer Senior is taking that idea on in her new book with the provocative title, All Joy and No Fun.
That title was a casual aside uttered by a friend of mine. He was a new father, and when asked what he thought of the gig, his response was, all joy and no fun, and I stole it.
All joy and no fun, that's the paradox of modern parenthood, as Jennifer Senior sees it. To untangle that paradox, she spent time observing parents interacting with their children and each other, and she went through scads of research studies about parental happiness. By and large, she says, those numbers are pretty discouraging.
We assume that children will improve our happiness. That's why babies are called bundles of joy. But what's so interesting is that one of the most robust findings in the social sciences, and it's been this way for about 50 years, is that children do not improve their parents' happiness. In general, they have a net effect of either zero or they slightly compromise their parents' happiness. There are exceptions, but overall, the effect is zero to a slight negative.
So for you, when you started looking at those numbers about happiness and being a parent, what was missing? What were those data leaving out?
Right. So what the data was really leaving out was, in my view, joy. On most of these questionnaires and surveys, joy is indistinguishable from other kind of pleasant feelings. You know, if you're happy, you just give it a five. You know, maybe a spinal tap analogy is good here. You know, I mean, I think that the joy really goes to 11. And there's no way to, you know, kind of measure that necessarily on a scale of 1 to 5. That 5 you're feeling when your kid laughs or when your kid says something that is so totally, like, amazingly weird or insightful or sensitive, it's not the same as, like, getting a good laugh out of watching a movie or having a really nice time with a friend. It's just, like, a different category of experience. And the fact that they all just numerically translate into the same thing is frustrating.
One of the studies that got a lot of attention came from the behavioral economist Daniel Kahneman, and he asked a bunch of working women what activities gave them the most pleasure. And lo and behold, childcare was way down on the list, 16th out of 19.
That study blows my doors off every time I hear somebody repeat it back to me. What's truly amazing about Danny Kahneman's study is that when the women were answering this question, they didn't even realize they were ranking childcare so low. Daniel Kahneman did not design this study to determine how happy moms were. He simply wanted to know how happy people were during the day as they were going about doing their daily business. And only at the end, when everything was all added up, did he discover that parents would have preferred, napping, answering emails, shopping, watching TV.
Housework.
Housework, vacuuming, clocked in higher, which is amazing.
You spend time observing different families around the country, and I wanted to ask you about a couple in Minnesota, Clint and Angie. And as you describe them, they both do shift work. They have two small kids. She's a psychiatric nurse. He manages rental car locations. But it's really clear from your narrative that the toll of taking care of their kids weighs very differently on them. She feels guilty all the time, right, that she's not doing enough. And Clint is very forgiving of himself. And he put it this way. It really struck me. He says, at home, I am the standard. I feel like I do it the way it should be done. She doesn't have that.
I feel like I want to make up bumper stickers that say, I am the standard, and give them to every woman I know. So women seem to have this running ticker tape of concerns in their heads all the time about their kids, whereas men just have this great gift of compartmentalization. And this is not just me speaking anecdotally. This has been borne out in not just one study, but many. And, you know, the amount of kind of psychological effort that women sort of spend on their kids in addition to physical effort and all that stuff is really quite striking. And the kind of amount of time that women spend berating themselves for not spending enough time with their kids.
Or not spending the right time with their
kids. Or not doing the right, that's right, or spending the wrong kind of time with them. Heaven forbid that they actually, you know, turn on the television and let their kids watch TV for half an hour so that they can do the dishes, you know. It's really striking what the differences are. So what blew me away about Angie and Clint is that Angie, during the day, she works with psychotics who are often in a delusional state and quite violent and will bite and will kick and will hit. Yet she told me, without any equivocation or ambiguity, that she found her home life and her role as a mother much, much harder because she's not sure what she's supposed to do as a mom. Whereas Clint, who sits at a desk, he's not contending with delusional patients. He finds working with his kids much easier. He finds his role of parent much easier.
Because he's defined it for himself.
Because he just says, because I am the standard. He's very confident that what he's doing is just fine. He doesn't second guess himself at all. Whereas when he's at work, he's second guessing himself all the time. That whole exchange, that said everything to me in a very small universe. I heard all of the differences between how men approach this job and how women do.
How leery are you of making broad generalizations about how women and how men parent differently, approach parenting differently in a book like this? Because obviously there are so many exceptions to every rule.
Oh, right? My God, terribly. And if you knew how many times I kind of hit select all, delete on those parts of the book, the fact that there was so much data about this made it a more comfortable assertion to make, so much so that I actually stand by my initial declaration. I want those bumper stickers made for all the gals we know.
I am the standard.
I am the standard.
In the end, at the end of writing this book, do you think you've come to understand yourself as a mother and maybe as a wife any differently than you did when you went in?
In many ways, yes. I mean, first of all, I think a lot of the material that I read about joy and meaning is something that I think about all the time now. And, you know, I do feel like having spoken to parents of adult children and watching them well up with this wild sense of pride and accomplishment, knowing what they know about who they've produced in the world, it's sort of an unrivaled feeling. I think also some of the data also that I ran across just helped me figure out how to be a better wife. I have now learned that if I have something to do on a Saturday, I say so on a Tuesday, and we make plans for me to do that so that on Saturday we're not duking it out about who gets the 3 hours. So, oh, yeah. For sure.
Jennifer Senior, her new book is titled All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
One of the world's most beloved books is The Little Prince by Antoine Saint-Exupéry. Published in 1943, more than a million copies are sold every year in some 250 languages. If I were to ask you, where do you think the French children's book was written, you might say Paris or Marseille. You'd be wrong. How about Long Island, as in Long Island, New York? NPR's Margot Adler reports.
When the late Nikos Kefalidis bought the house on Bevan Road in Northport, Long Island in the late 1970s, he knew that 30 years before, Saint-Exupéry had written and illustrated part of Le Petit Prince in that house. It was something known in the community, but not in many other places. His wife, Laurie Kefalidis, has stood in the room where Saint-Exupéry wrote and is happy about the book's connection to her house. She has copies of The Little Prince in some 30 languages. We sat in a coffee shop in Manhattan.
I think it's about life and death and what's important in life. And I think he talks about falsehood or untruths or hypocrisy or duplicity in a very charming way, actually.
Saint-Exupéry also wrote the book in Manhattan. The Morgan Library and Museum bought the original manuscript of The Little Prince in 1968 and many other drawings, including precursors to what ended up in the book. They had an exhibition on the 50th anniversary of publication 20 years ago, but their new exhibition, here until May, looks at the author's creative process. The curator of the show, The Little Prince, A New York Story, is Christine Nelson. Saint-Exupéry, she says, was a meticulous craftsman, but his working habits were somewhat chaotic.
Wherever he went, he had stacks of onion skin paper with him and always a cup of coffee or tea by his side, always a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. The manuscript we have here even has stains on many of the corners of the pages. One of the drawings even has a cigarette burn, which we've left for people to see.
Saint-Exupéry came to New York in 1940 after the Germans occupied France. Writer and aviator, he left just after the publication of the book and returned to fly reconnaissance missions for the Allies. Before he left, he took his drawings and writings, many of which were deleted from the final book, and gave them in a brown paper bag to a friend, Sylvia Hamilton. Nelson shows me an extraordinary letter Saint-Exupéry wrote and illustrated for a friend in 1940 when he was still in France. A man looking very much like the author is standing on a cloud.
Of course, in the book, it becomes a planet. And then all of this is floating above an image of Earth. And what do we see on Earth but a little sheep that looks very much like the sheep that appears in the opening lines of The Little Prince?
A flower?
And of course, a flower, and the little prince has a beloved flower on his planet.
The pictures evolve from an adult that looks like the author with thinning hair and a bow tie to the little prince. There are pages of writing, all in French, he never mastered English, of sections that were deleted from the book, including several adventures on Earth, and one page on the wall mentions places in New York.
I'm going to point out right here a reference to Long Island. You see it there? Here's one to Manhattan. It's very tiny, but you see it.
These were all deleted from the final text. There's a section where the narrator talks about humans' inflated sense of self. He says, she notes,
we think we dominate the Earth, and yet we really don't take up so much space at all. He says, if we got everyone on Earth together for a big meeting, we could fit everyone onto a small Pacific island. But in the manuscript, instead of a Pacific island, it's Long Island.
When you ask people their favorite part of The Little Prince, so many talk about the boa constrictor eating the elephant, how adults only see it as a hat, or the final drawing of a sheep, just three holes in a box, and the secret told to the little prince by the fox.
What is essential is invisible to the eye. It reminds us of that beginning of the story, you know. What's essential is what you can't see, what's inside the snake, what's inside your heart.
In the end, we will never know if the little prince makes it back to his planet or dies. 1 year after the book came out, Saint-Exupéry also disappeared into thin air during a reconnaissance mission on July 31st, 1944. Years later, parts of the plane were found, and a fisherman near Marseille found a silver bracelet in his net, a bracelet that's in the exhibit. It has his name, the address of his publisher, and the words NYC, USA. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
For generations, this country has honored its founding fathers. The historian Joseph J. Ellis, in a memorable book, called them the Founding Brothers. But our image of the women who helped to found this country has been a little bit more obscure until recently. Cokie Roberts, a longtime NPR contributor, is the author of Founding Mothers, Remembering the Ladies, which has just been turned into an illustrated children's book. Cokie reminds us that these women were pretty hardcore. Take Martha Washington, for instance, who was not nearly as matronly as you may think.
Every single winter of the Revolution, she went to camp with him, and he begged her to come to camp because she was so important, she and the other officers' wives, were so important for troop morale. And Martha Washington would come roaring into camp in her carriage, and people would cheer her into camp. Lady Washington is here. And then she would sew for the soldiers and cook for the soldiers and pray with the soldiers and nurse the soldiers. They adored her.
Now, when they're in winter quarters, of course, that's not when they're campaigning, but when Washington's army would go out and fight the British or move around, weren't there women with it as well?
Yes, there were women who went with the soldiers as camp followers. These were generally poor women who couldn't afford to stay home because, of course, there were no jobs for women. And they would cook for the soldiers and do some jobs, and they got a tiny bit of pay to help out with the army. And then, of course, there were women who were on the battlefield doing things like watering the cannons, and then the men would get hit, and they'd take over the cannon.
So you have women accompanying men during the Revolutionary War in the Continental Army, but you also write of women who stand in for their husbands. I'm particularly thinking of Benjamin Franklin's wife, Deborah.
Well, yes, that is so interesting because, of course, as children, we all learn that Benjamin Franklin was the first Postmaster General of the United States. What we don't learn is that he wasn't in the United States. He was in England, and he was for years and years and years. And Deborah Franklin ran the Postal Service. She ran the printing shops, which were essentially franchises that went out to the frontier, which was Pittsburgh, and she ran all of his businesses, and he thought she did a grand job of it.
Wow. Cokie, do these stories suggest that women's roles in this historic period were a little different than we imagine them to be?
Totally. I think that we think women were sitting around tending to the tatting or pouring tea, and it's our view of first ladies, too, and it's all wrong. These were very, very politically passionate women. Their letters are full of politics, and they were utterly devoted to the patriot cause. Abigail Adams at one point wrote to John Adams, "You know, we women are really better patriots than you men are, because we are suffering all of the hardships and making all of the sacrifices for the cause. And if we win, you men will be held in high acclaim and hold office, and we won't even be able to vote. So we're better patriots." And John had sense enough to agree with her.
Well, of course he would. Of course he would. He agreed with her a lot in that correspondence.
Well, except when she told him to remember the ladies, probably the most famous line of American patriot women.
What was she referring to?
They were considering a Declaration of Independence, something that she thought they were way too timid about. She had been militating for a year for them to declare independency from Britain. And when they were finally mulling it, she said, "I suppose that we will have to have a new code of laws for our new government. And when you write it, remember the ladies." And she was saying that men would be tyrants if they could. Of course, at the time, married women could not own property. Of course, women couldn't vote. Women had no legal or political rights. And so she was trying to argue for those rights, and John just laughed at her.
Now, as you try to tell their stories, boil down their stories for kids, Cokie Roberts, did you struggle with the complexities of their lives? I'm particularly thinking of the fact that quite a few of the women who would be the founding mothers were also slave owners, just like the men.
Well, sure. And of course, slavery has been the issue and the sin that hovered over this great American experiment from the beginning. I do feature Phyllis Wheatley, a slave girl from New England who became a renowned poet. But I think that in itself is quite interesting, because I think that a lot of people have no notion that slavery was in all the colonies at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it took some brave people to eliminate it in the northern colonies before the country became a country.
What made you want to tell these stories for kids?
Well, I feel strongly that when you recognize people in history, that history is more relevant to you. And our little girls have a hard time recognizing people in the great story of America. And at the National Archives, the closest thing we have to a cathedral of the country, there are these fabulous murals up on the walls above the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. And they're all white men in white wigs with tights. And I don't think they're recognizable to a lot of Americans. But they weren't the only people who did it. They were incredibly important. I'm not taking anything away from our founding fathers, but they didn't do it alone.
Cokie Roberts, who's heard on this program most Mondays and is also the author of Founding Mothers, which is now a children's book. Cokie, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
You can get a look at some of the illustrations in that book and read some excerpts by going to npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.